Welcome to Electronically Yours with Martin Ware.
Hi, it's Martin here, Electronically Yours, once again. Today's guest is a very famous dude. He is the main driving force behind The Orb, who were massively successful in the 90s, in the dance scene, specializing in, I suppose you'd say, psychedelic, ambient, house, trip-hop, dub, electronic. And Alex is such a lovely guy, still creating amazing stuff now. He's got a new album out, which you need to check out, and he's mentioned in the interview. He's been at the forefront of kind of, I suppose, pop-oriented, but uncompromising stuff that has done exceptionally well in the charts, in Britain in particular. And he's worked with some, you know, really famous people and done remixes for loads of them. And so here he is, the amazing Alex Patterson. So let's talk about you growing up and your inspirations. And I know that you went to school with
Martin Glover. Martin Glover is his real name, yeah.
That's right.
It's a good day to talk about things like that because it's the anniversary of my only brother dying 22 years ago today.
Oh, awesome.
So I'm in a very reflective mood.
Right.
And his name is Martin.
Right. My name's Martin. There you go.
And Martin Glover is youth. So.
A lot of Martins. Yeah, I interviewed Martin, actually. He's an interesting dude. I really liked him. I mean, he's a maverick, and I suppose you are as well. And
we're made from the same ilk. We went to a very weird boarding school. It wasn't just a normal school.
Right.
We had to stay there and board there.
Right.
And we knew each other from very young, since we were both 13 years old.
You were in a band together originally, weren't you? Were you?
I don't know. That'd be a new one on me.
Maybe not.
I mean, we started our own record label back in '88.
Right.
Called WOW, WAU.
That's right.
Which kind of gave birth to The Orb in many ways.
Yeah. And
nobody else wanted me.
Oh, come now. So you were inspired by, according to what I've read anyway, by a lot of kind of New York radio stations and kind of a sci-fi aesthetic. And actually, a lot of your influences are very similar to, you know, our influence in the Human League and Hammer 17, really.
Sure.
Eno and, you know, kind of kraut rock and...
Listen to the voice of Buddha, things like that. We were behind you in time-wise. I was
there. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but with Human League, we're definitely out there. One of my favourite things as an old DJ would be putting the same track by Heaven 17, Voice of Buddha track, and just put a tiny little delay over one. So you've got 2 7-inches.
Yeah.
And 1 7-inch is just a tiny second, millisecond behind the other, so it's got a constant echo over the track.
Oh, nice.
These are the sort of things that's the only thing you had back in those days. You didn't have any kind of like, you didn't have an instant reverb or instant echo machine.
That's right.
Even there's a DJ you can do now. So, they were just like inspirational little moments for myself, and then I get to make a mix of it in a punk club in Amsterdam.
Amazing.
So tell us about back in the early 80s.
Tell us about your early tell us about your process when you used to use lots of, you know, even use multi-tracks, didn't you, live, and as well as record decks and stuff.
Yeah, I mean that was a bit of showing off with having a studio engineer who knew how to use 24 tracks and 48 tracks and 24 tracks with some different types of effects on it. And rather than just being in the studio, we decided to take it live. And one of the original sort of bloke, Chris Weston, or Thrash as we called him in those days, he tended to basically just blag it all and just do everything off a DAT machine.
Right.
And then we got Andy Hughes to come in and do it properly. And he was notorious of, but it's almost like living in Salt Lake City with him, when you would be constantly up all night making noises. But they would be for a reason. And by the end of it, you'd have 24 tracks to play with, another 24 tracks to put mixes over the top of those 24 tracks. Live, instantaneous. I kind of learned my... Today, now, when I work with Michael in the studio, we can just spend 2 hours of a day and spend the rest of the time enjoying ourselves, having a cup of tea and talking about what we're going to do, and then do it. And within those 2 hours, we'll have an hour's worth of proper mixes. That's because we're on the fly. I work as a DJ, definitely taking 5 different ideas and mixing it down into one idea, and somehow morphing all those things into that one moment. And if it doesn't work, move on to the next bit. Don't get too precious about it. All things said and done, I mean, as I said, today is a very special day in different reasons. And with my older brother, he was the musician in the family. I woke up when I was born. I had a guitar stuffed up. I've got pictures of me as a baby with my brother with a guitar in his hand.
Is that right?
And that just sums it all up. I was blessed with having an older brother who, from year zero, I was subjected to lots of his guitar ideas.
He
I grew up on Bob Dylan, as might go to sleep in the cupboard in the house party, and I'd be in the cupboard with all the coats. That's where I'd be sleeping. That's as a kid growing up. So that's just something that, yeah. I miss him, but at the same point, this is something that you learn as a human, that you do miss people, but you should. This is definitely a time where I've not been bawling my eyes out thinking how much I miss my brother today. It's 22 years ago today, and I'm very, very reflective. It's like another lifetime. 22 years ago.
Long time.
What were you doing in 2001? It doesn't feel like a long time ago for us oldies.
Yeah.
But my daughter was born that year. She was 6 months old. And now she's doing what we all should be doing, is enjoying our lives. And she's off in Central America for the summer.
Oh, how beautiful.
What an amazing thing to do. I'm really proud of her, 22, to just pull out... Take a year out of and she did. She's this criminal psychology, for God's sake.
Jesus Christ.
I know when you got it misses a generation, the musical thing. So I'm waiting for the grandkids to be musical,
right?
And my son's equally so. He's like a monster, he's 6'2", and he loves maths and physics and English literature. Okay, but he likes the orb. Give him, bless him.
How beautiful. I mean, my children are 27 and 24 now, so similar age distance, a bit older. But what a journey it is, bringing up children. It's just fantastic, I think.
I totally.
I mean, it's stressful occasionally, but I wouldn't change it for the world. And so let's go back to the start of your kind of success, really. I mean, Jimmy Courtney, right? Tell me about Jimmy.
Is it the truth or not?
I don't know. Whatever you can get away with.
Whatever I can get away with, Jimmy Courtney. Well, he's an artist. He's not a musician. There you go. He always wanted to be... When I first got to know Jimmy, he was the out front sound guy for Brilliant, and then got pushed onto stage by Youth to play guitar.
Right.
And then he took that and became very well established as a guitarist and did care less. That wasn't me, was that? He was also definitely into dance music in a bigger. It wasn't so much like a. There's some people who were taking what we were doing in 88 as a fad, as something that was really cool to be in that year, but next year we're not going to be cool and we're not going to do it.
Right.
With the Auburn, it's history. It tells you, I've got it all in black and white, what I've been doing since 1989, 88, really, with it's recorded. So I haven't really changed that much from what I'm doing. It's a form of experimentation, which can be very loosely coined as ambient or experimental hip hop, or we've moved into different genres, which we try to touch, but not really relate too much to. Grime is an example, by taking some of the rhythms, but keeping the top parts kind of poppy as opposed to grimy. And also I'm a white man playing black music. I love black music. I grew up in the era when it was Black Echoes. It wasn't just Echoes, it was Black Echoes.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, that
our manager used to be editor of Black Echoes, actually.
There you go. Yeah.
So I mean, I grew up with Northern Soul and Motown. Sure. I mean, that was my preferred music. But I've always, like you, had eclectic tastes. So, but you are in a profession. Your process is all about combining different influences and creating a tension between them, which creates something new. Correct?
Right. Yeah. And it's also about doing your own thing and not going, everyone else is doing that, I've got to do it myself. It's an innovator, a pioneer, as opposed to someone who's going to do something because someone else has done it. And that's where we've kept up ahead of the game for so long because of that.
It's amazing. I was listening to your back catalogue this morning. I mean, it covers such a wide range of influences and styles, and I'm completely there for eclecticism. I've always believed, you know, what I mean, obviously I've produced a lot of people, and I'm always saying, they always say to me, do we need to make all the tracks on the album sound kind of similar? And I said, no, because your artistic intention is what binds it together. So be diverse, do the opposite.
Sure.
I really believe that. And when I produced Terence Trent D'Arby's first album, if somebody's got a great voice, for instance, that links everything together. But a style is a key thing, isn't it? And I just think your work is really, really impressive. I mean, and it's got depth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always, I'm not just saying that now because I'm talking to you. I've always been a bit of a fan, to be honest. So thank you for the music.
That's what I've been put on this planet for. If it wasn't to Roadie for Killing Joke, but that was how I started and how I earned my spurs, I suppose. I'm trying to think of a word. Here I am, and I'm...
And
Lemmy from Motorhead was something that, as a roadie, watching him being in Motorhead and knowing that he was actually a roadie to start off with in his own right, that gave me inspired me to carry on and do my own thing. Even if someone, you've got to start from somewhere. And you're a bunch of mates and you get a band together. I was the mate who had the short straw. I became a roadie in the band. It's just the way it was. That's kind of, they needed a roadie. No one knew what a roadie was, so I decided to become a roadie. There was five of us, six of us, the original Kenny Joke lineup, there was one other person, that was myself, and there was the manager.
Right.
That was it, back in 79. It was...
How amazing.
I just took it on board. But then I was a sick... I'd been to school with youth. I'd been his prefect at school. I'd looked after him, made sure he wasn't going to get out of hand.
Right.
And keep him away from being bullied as well, because there's a big thing at boarding schools. You get bullied a lot when you're little.
Oh, it makes you a man, you know.
Yeah, being bullied, it's fucking horrible. I'd rather people would actually say, no.
Yeah.
At schools, when you've got people like that, they just really need to be sort of like...
I was going to say, who were your major influences musically at that point?
At that point?
And did it change a lot when you became the Orb?
Yeah. But then maybe not. Mark Boland's T-Rex was the very first one. First album, first album was T-Rex. And then I kind of went into a real sort of doom and gloom with Alice Cooper.
I love Alice Cooper.
Fucking beautiful Alice Cooper. Generation Landslide. What a song.
Amazing.
It's an acoustic song with a melody. And everyone thinks that Alice Cooper is somebody that's just shouty and going on about dead and death. And you're so wrong.
He's a smart guy. You know, Frank Zappa wouldn't have signed him if not, you know. That was the first album I ever bought was Pretty's For You by Alice Cooper. And my favourite ever gig was Mark Bolan at Sheffield City Hall on the Electric Warrior Tour, was just immense. And after four numbers, we were like kind of four rows from the front. He split his trousers and his bollocks rang in it. And I thought, everybody's looking at it going, is that real? Or is it some kind of stage act or something? Because they were completely hairless. I remember this. They were just pink. And I thought, nah, it can't be real. And anyway, he ran off, came back in 4 or 5 minutes and had different trousers on, so it must have been real. That made a big impression on me, I have to say.
It would do, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a similar thing, but only very remodulately. My brother was in a band called Rudy Tchaikovsky that supported Blue Mink. Blue Mink were on Top of the Pops. I'm sitting in the front room watching Top of the Pops with my brother, and he's laughing his head. What's the funny bit here? Well, I don't get it. Because they're all miming.
Right.
None of them are the real... The drummer's being the guitarist, the singer's being the bass player. And no one would get it because they're all miming. And that stuck with me. That's why I ended up playing chess on Top of the Pops, because I knew that you could get away with miming.
In a space.
That's a direct reason why I thought, I'm in the know. I know that they don't do these things live on Top of the Pops.
And what did the producers, the director of the show, think?
Didn't want to hated us. They wanted to get us off the gate. We started off at 12 o'clock drinking bottles of brandy. And we were told at half past 12 that we'd get thrown off the set if we walked around with any more brandy. So we just poured the brandy into Coca-Cola, cans of Coke, and carried on drinking. It was ridiculous. It was, and then at 5 o'clock, everybody went to the pub.
Oh, shit.
And Take That were there. That was quite amusing. And a year later, I had... Robbie Williams coming at me going, I've heard where you're brilliant. I saw you. Never seen a band do that at Top of the Pops before. You got away with murder. That's brilliant. I made an impression on him.
More rock and roll than rock and roll, isn't it, really?
Well, really. That's what I think. When you've got personal managers and personal trainers, it's a bit of a different world, isn't it, compared to...
It is a bit, yeah.
Yes, boys, I think they are, aren't they? Yes, we'll do that, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So coming on with the Orb or any normal band would go, a cough. I'm not doing that.
So you did some stuff. You do a lot of your shows are with, you use a lot of light shows and imagery and and stuff. So, I mean, do you do that? Do you have somebody who operates all that for you? So
that's someone operating, yeah. It's an old friend, Gary. He used to do visuals for Duran Duran, funny enough.
Oh, right. Cool.
And, that was one of those funny moments where I met the singer out of Duran Duran, and he looked at me and went, really offishly, and stuck his nose up, went, Simon Le Bon. It's really funny. He didn't say Simon Le Bon. He went, what, you're the all? And then gave me that look and walked off. It's like, okay, right, you are then. So I'm just a DJ then to you, obviously. That was the other thing about growing up as a DJ in the music world. It would be quite, it's like, come on. I've earned my spurs again here. You don't have to tell me I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, the real payback is the fact that, you know, you've toured around the world, you performed to huge audiences, you've entertained people and made their lives happier. And isn't that the same as what somebody like Duran Duran is doing? It's just in a different format. That's
different, quite different way. Yeah, we did, and we're not all beautiful women. That's the other thing. And this is what it was. This is the direct thing. It was that I don't look the part to be in a band. I could see it. It was all coming at me because I'm standing behind DJing in front of all these private party in a studio in the West End. It's really quite sad. Yeah. I just happened to be there, and he happened to be in there going, what, you're the all? Sorry, I disappoint you.
Oh, right, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, not a lot of people do, but if you're a pop star and you're good looking, Bobby Gillespie would be the same time. What a twat, but there you go, that's rock and roll, isn't it? He's living off an album that was produced by someone who's not here anymore,
right?
So, and I've no shame in telling you this because I co-wrote Higher Than the Sun,
right?
My album, and they only gave us production credits.
Oh, that's not good, is it?
But that's Primal Scream. But there's only two of them left now.
Yeah, that happens. Well, I mean, it happens a lot in the industry, doesn't it? Also, we need to talk about the problems that you, and I've talked to lots of other DJs as well, American, British, etc., about the dawn of making records from samples from other people and getting clearances and all this nonsense. I know you had some issues with that. So tell me your experiences of all this.
Well, my experiences of all that is I discovered that there were real bands who were doing that way before me.
Right.
Led Zeppelin, a perfect example. First two albums, and not them at all.
Who are they then?
Led Zeppelin. If you just have to Google that, you'll see that there's the film rights on the song rights on those songs. And old blues songs from southern states of America.
Right, right.
The Beatles, they gave people credit for the samples they used or wrote songs.
Yeah, of course.
But they weren't their songs. What I'm saying is it's around a lot longer than just the Orb or KLF or the Copyright. Yeah. Copyright Infringement Society, or whatever you want to call yourselves these days. The thing is, that with a computer now, you can actually, if you spend like 15 minutes looking for a song, you can probably find a sample on any song you want. It's a question you've got the time or the patience to get that kind of information out of the computer.
There's that website, isn't there? Who sampled? Is it?
Yeah.
That's quite interesting, actually.
Sure. I mean, we spent most of our lives doing that anyway.
Yeah.
In a live performance, where you're not even thinking it's a live performance, you're just doing a gig, and there's loads of people pretty much having a good time in the middle of the night. You're doing a set at 2 a.m. to say 4 a.m. You're not getting the people are probably going to be as high as kites. They're not going to be sitting there wondering what that record, where that record comes from. They're going to be listening to the moment and enjoying what's coming out of that record.
Exactly.
Very much like what an Andy Weatherall DJ set would have been.
Yeah.
Which was a moment in time where you can, a lot of people I know can relate to those moments when Andy were doing sets that blew people's minds away. I was just lucky to have him as a friend, as a neighbour.
Yeah, he's a good man. Yeah. I met him a couple of times. And, yeah, got a lot of time for him. In fact, you know, through this podcast, I was never involved in the DJ scene, although I do DJ a bit, but I was never involved in that 90s mm-hmm. DJ scene, noughties. But I've grown to respect a lot of people who were the kind of key players in that scene, both in America and
yeah, yeah, sure.
And I've interviewed a lot of them. And I think in the fullness of time that, because at the time it was a kind of it was a very high profile and well rewarded scene. I mean, you could, you know, obviously get paid a reasonable amount of money to do what you did. And it was more difficult for traditional bands at that point. But I think in the fullness of time, it won't be regarded as so much of a kind of commercial thing. It will be regarded as, you know, a completely separate art form, like hip hop or, you know, mm-hmm. rock and roll or whatever. I mean, once you get to people like DJ Shadow and the Avalanches, we are looking at true art, I think. It's like taking that theory of combining samples to the extreme and creating new work, composite works, but God almighty. I mean, the Avalanches, it took them 2 years to get the clearances, didn't it?
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, there is that. Yeah.
What do you feel about all that? I mean, I think they're called compound works now. I mean, it's not as hard. I mean, there are still arsehole record companies who will just have bots trawling the internet all the time, taking stuff down if they spot something. But I just think if we have the technology to do it, you know, if people feel they are compensated for their participation in anything, I think it's fantastic. It's a new art form, isn't it?
Well, it's not so much a new one, but at the same point, but then things in 2023, I mean, I just see a new wave of punk coming flying at me from all sides.
Really?
That's how I feel what's going on. And the music is so less produced. Even though the production on an old record would have been in the old days of 48 tracks in the studio, now we do everything pretty much like we were on compact records in Germany for so long that we decided that we would be compact and we would put everything down into minimalize everything.
Right.
And that's what we are. We're basically four CD players and a laptop. And then whatever visuals, we'll throw visuals in that night live from one of the computers. So it's much more radical and much more of the night, as opposed to it pre-planned and something that we're going to do this could be grand and ready to. These are on the fly.
Do you film your or record them in some way that can be people can play them back later? Any of these sets?
Well, I used to be dead against that.
Right.
I always thought I was an old punk in the sense that it's for the here and the now.
Yeah.
If you didn't come and you didn't turn up, then fuck you. Come and you missed it.
Yeah.
This is our gig, nobody else's. Why should I record it and have it played back later when it just there's no true art form to it? And I'm very much the same. I haven't lost that
right.
That need to do something special for people that would spend the time to come and see you do that in the first place.
But what about somebody, people who can't be there? I mean, you know.
Well, that's
about live streaming.
That becomes because the world has become a smaller place. Yeah. It was much bigger before when we were little, and there was much less chance of people turning up and seeing you.
Right.
Whereas now, people could just get somebody can put something on your iPhone and start talking to you about what they want to do tonight. It wasn't the same in the 70s and 80s.
No, of course.
Definitely not. And really, in the 90s, it wasn't like that either. It was definitely, we didn't want to running around with our iPhones, that's for sure.
No, it's since the start of smartphones that the world has radically, really.
I mean, I spent most of the other afternoon, two friends turned up who brought some model girls who were just, they set up like a network of 90 people to talk about art. It was all too far too much for me, to be honest. Just for the afternoon, I'd rather just sit down and talk to two people, not get another 90 people involved because I've got an iPhone. But this is where we're going now.
Yeah.
The generations below us, they're going to be trying to outdo each other again. And that's their way of outdoing each other.
Well, neural implants is next, isn't it? That's what I read.
If it's not already happened.
Yeah, if it's not already happened.
Yeah.
So tell us about... Dave Gilmore, you did some stuff with him, right?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Gilmore.
I know him a bit. He seems like a nice
dude. He's up there, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's definitely up there.
And you were called Floyd.
I would love it if he actually spoke to me.
Oh.
Yeah, put it that way, rather than his manager having to talk to me.
Oh.
That's quite sad, really. That's the joys of knowing someone in Pink Floyd. And in many ways, an old school friend of mine, Guy Pratt, who's been in
the Pink Floyd. Yeah, I know Guy, yeah.
Bless him. I mean, he waddled around thinking he's been Pink Floyd, when really, come on. come on, mate. As he told one of my old friends at a dinner party, I was only 10 when it wrote Dark Side of the Moon, Darling. So
Right.
He's realised that now and again, and he's got so much going for him, Guy. Anyway, and I love him dearly. He's one of my oldest friends. I've known him since we were both 10 years old.
His podcast is really good. I really like it.
And he's full of energy. He's got a really positive energy about him, Guy.
Yeah, I've played for Hem 17 a few times in the studio. I really rate him as a player, particularly
as a musician as well. Yeah, sure. I mean, not many people get a job doing a bass for a Michael Jackson, and
not
he did
at all.
No. And he did. A little white skinny kid from fucking Waterloo. Hello, that's how far I know we go that way back. I mean, I used to fancy his daughter, his sister when we were little.
Right,
guys, Karen. So we go back so far back, and you know he's openly admitted that he was a bit frightened of me when we were little, but that was only because if anybody said anything, I'd hit him. And so people knew that if you don't antagonise Patterson, because he'll hit you.
Oh no, God, you're not a violent person, are you?
No, I'm not. But I mean, I'll just make sure that if they're pissing me off, I'll let them know.
I don't want to cross you. I definitely don't want to piss you off.
No, I still don't want to be pissed off either.
But that's
the connection between Pink Floyd and the Orb in that funny world is Guy Pratt. In 87, he went off on tour with Pink Floyd. In 91, in 1990, we started doing the first Orb album. And I asked him along, said, would you like to come and do some bass on a track I'm doing with Jake Lemesurier? He's a dear friend who died very, very soon after that. And that was just one of those magical moments. We've got two people that are really talented to do a track on a new project. And the beautiful thing about the first Orb album was no one was bothering me. No one gave a shit. As long as I came under budget or on budget and doing the album, here's 20 grand, make yourself an album. Don't worry, I'll do a double. But you can't do a double album, 20 grand. Watch me. And I came in at 18.5 grand. I was real happy with myself.
Yeah.
See, this is me, and this is how I'm doing it. And I was, any chance of getting a triple? Look away.
You couldn't afford to manufacture it, probably.
Yeah, no, but the Americans were just... They were looking at me going, you want us to put out a triple album of an artist who's never had a hit single?
That'd be so cool, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I got a double. And they put it down to the first album was reduced down to a single album by the Americans, only for fans to write in and say, can we have the other one and a half size you've taken off the original first Orb album that came out in the UK, which is the double CD. Right. They reduced it down to a single CD.
Right.
And within 2 years, the American company brought it back up and released the double album again.
And has that been re-released?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, clever clogs. What we did was... I still want to get a triple album here if I can get
you
a triple album.
Do it.
I got a remix album done by all the artists I worked with on the first album. I got them to do a remix album and released and deleted it on the same day. 50,000 copies from flying out the door, and that was it.
Fantastic.
No one else had thought of that idea to release and, you know, release it and then delete it on the same day.
I'm a big fan of making things collectible. And that goes not just for physical product, but also for, you know, posters or, you know, live experiences, as you were talking about. I think that shows a consideration for your fan base, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It sort of involves people who want to just go, well, you know, if it's a limited edition, maybe it could be worth something in the future and all that. There's not enough of that shit going on now, I think.
Hmm.
Anyway, and you released a 40-minute single, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, that was the other thing. Yeah, they changed the rules for it because of us as well, which is nice.
Did they?
Yeah, they did. The BB, they didn't like us one bit on that one. So
get played on the radio.
You're allowed 40 minutes. Well, actually, 39 minutes, 58 seconds. That's what I did 39 minutes, because I knew that if it 40, it became an album. And then they changed it to 20 minutes. So that it's never going to happen again. That was just a.
But did you do a radio edit? Presumably.
Well, we did a Top of the Pops. We actually played Chess on Top of the Pops of this song.
And that's
the
one where you played the Chess.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Too much drinking, I reckon. Too many drugs, too much drinking.
Well, yeah, no. But they definitely too much to drink that day as well. We shouldn't have been. But then it was Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And I'd already done Top of the Pops as a roadie with Killing Joke when Jazz had decided to, Jazz the singer had decided to abort and leave the country and run off to Iceland because he thought there was going to be the start of a new nuclear war with the Falklands War. And Killing Joke were the only band that's ever been on Top of the Pops, and the next week the single went down in the charts.
Wow.
Just, they had a mannequin on stage. They didn't even have an actor or another singer, just a mannequin on stage pretending to be Jazz.
I'm amazed they let them do it.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. So do you still do large scale gigs and tour and stuff?
Yes. We're going to Manchester next week, doing a gig there, at the renowned Hole in the Wall, which is it used to be a great little venue. It's a bigger venue now, but still a good venue. And then doing a festival in Malta.
Oh, nice.
The weekend of the King's celebrations or whatever they are.
Oh, yeah, I'm doing a gig on the day of the coronation in Sheffield, so fuck the king.
I'm sure it should be that, surely. It may become. I did an album called Abolition of the Royal Familiar.
I know you did, yeah. Well done, you.
And I'm thinking, I got away with that. There's that, because when she did go, when she pops away, you can't do that, you can't say that about our queen. Yes, I can. No, you can't.
I think it's open season on the monarchy now, because
with Charles,
taking Charles seriously, I don't think.
Well, Charles, the last Charles wasn't he executed on his farm? Charles the Third.
Him and the whole fucking Tory government can go.
The whole lot of them.
Lamppost, as far as I'm concerned. But I am a little bit kind of on that edge of the.
Well, you know,
the title. Hold on, the Transit Kings. Tell me about them.
Blimey. Okay, the Transit Kings was a short-lived sort of project involving Jimmy Courty. Jimmy Courty decided to jump back in, become a musician for a millisecond, and it was Guy Pratt.
Yeah.
Guy Pratt and Jimmy Courty, the two main musicians, and myself and Don Beacon doing the groundwork, doing all the studio work, and then coming in and going, yeah, we like that, no, don't like that, you do like that. Got some really good gigs in Japan, and Jimmy decided that he didn't want to be in the band.
Oh, great.
There you go. And that was that. And that was that. So we had him come over to Japan to do some visuals. And the Japanese rejected all his visuals because they were all really kind of a lot to do with 911, basically. And it was just wouldn't have, they wouldn't, it, doing a big gig in Japan, you wouldn't have gone down well with the promoters, the agents, that thing.
He's an iconoclast, though, isn't he? He craves that notoriety, right?
Constantly. I mean, KLF is, they're still trying to make some kind of noise about them, which I find is kind of a bit boring, to be honest. I mean, unfortunately, I know them too well. I know what the Chill Out album, KLF.
Yeah.
It's myself DJing.
Oh, right. Okay.
80% of the album is me.
Is it?
With no percent of credit.
Oh, zero. No.
And that's them again. That's KLF all over. So they're
why did you not agree beforehand all the credit then?
It's just one of those things. They tell me all the way up until the album's being released. They're telling me that you're getting a credit, you're getting this. We'll let the world know that you've been part of it. Bollocks.
Oh, that's so sad. I hate
that. And that's kind of at the same time me and Jimmy were doing a first Orb album, which he then decided it wasn't good enough. And so he decided to call the album Jimmy Courty, the Jimmy Courty album. Would you be friends with someone who did that to you?
No.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So I'm very reserved about anything that if he sends me a message, it usually goes to the back of the, I'm not interested in what he might be.
I only have one major rule in my career, which is no arseholes.
Well, he's sent into one of them, definitely. There's a really good friend of mine called Phil Dogg, a South Londoner. Whereas I said to Mike, with Jimmy, he's from Devon, for a start. He doesn't, you know, sorry, but you know, I'm a Londoner. I come from South London. You do know your locals, even if you're a local. You get to, and you grow up. And Jimmy became part of KLF, and he had a squat in South London. So he was part of that South London community. But really, he could always escape back to Devon if he needed to. His family home was there, and all his family shit was down there.
Right. So do you know Bill Drummond?
No, I never needed to.
Okay.
I never needed to know Jimmy, Bill. He was a maverick. Totally.
Oh, really?
His
books, by the way.
Everyone's told me to be scared of him, be frightened of him. That's again, you're asking me to be frightened of someone. Come on, they can find us. I'm only going to laugh at him. Is he going to frighten me? I don't think so.
No.
And that's a bit. There was one time when Jimmy, we were doing a version of an Orb tune, which suddenly morphed into 3M Eternal.
Really?
He didn't like me very much for that. I put that out on an Orb tune for him and Bill to scream at me that you've got to take it out or we're going to kill you. Kind of, yeah. Don't let him get don't find out too much about it, and say so. Obsessions Volume 1, it's called Mummy Don't, and it's an old tune. I remember doing it because it's a song about my older brother being bullied by my mum. It's just one of those weird little songs that you remember and little things that you take. Mummy don't, mummy don't, mummy don't, kind of thing. Very dark, but it's also, you'll hear it on Obsessions. Well, you might not hear it now because we had to take that off and replace it with another song.
Right.
Because in the middle of it, it suddenly went into 3M Eternal and then came back into Mummy Don't.
So you had to take it down, right?
Yeah, where he got all shirty. You know, such is life.
Oh well. Toxygen. Did you pay for the rights for Oxygen to do that? I suppose you did.
No, we got invited by him by Jean-Michel Jarre to do a remix of Toxygen.
Oxygen.
There was nothing of Oxygen in there. And he rejected it. So I do not like this. This is not what I want. Okay, fair enough. It's a shame. So I took it to Ireland at the time, took it to a musicologist, and can't see any Toxygen in there. You're free to use it wherever you want.
Right.
And they went and got a top number four. Never had a number four in the singles tracks before. And everyone was sitting in there with not a vocal in sight. It was just genius. And that was all down to Mark Moreau over at Island Records going, this is a single. And there's Andy and I just going, don't get that one. And go, all right, we'll give it a go then. See, and they're, blimey, there we were. So another appearance on Top of the Pops. So we weren't just the one hit wonders by this point.
No, of course not. I mean, for people who don't know, how many albums have you put out now? 18, is it, or something?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
It's fucking ridiculous, man.
That's what I'm thinking myself. Maybe I should just stop making albums.
No. I mean, I have total admiration. I mean, I must admit, we kind of gave up when there was little prospect of going to be a lot of sales, you know. And then, of course, the whole scene's changed now, isn't it? So, but I mean, I suppose making stuff is its own reward, but B, it's also relatively cheap to do now. I mean, you know, the whole manufacturing of music has become emancipated in that respect. Mm-hmm. But everything that you guys do is of a certain very high quality. I mean, it's really, really clear to me, and I've listened to a lot of stuff from this period now, because of research for all the different things that, you know, there are some people, like Mark Moore, for instance, his stuff is just pristine and beautifully produced and engineered, and yours is the same. But there's a lot of dance stuff that's a bit approximate. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you take pride in the whole, the clarity of thought involved in the, you know, and the way that you construct things? Are you, do you have like a builder's pride of craftsmanship of all this stuff?
Well, I think very much so. I mean, I'm very much, very proud of this new album.
Sounds great.
We've moved in a direction since Thomas left the band to 2016 and Michael's taken over. We've moved into a direction where, with Michael was feeding me things, whereas with Thomas, he was feeding himself, which is fine. But with Michael, it's a different relationship. As an engineer artist, he's feeding me things all the time.
Right.
It's almost a unique situation to be. I've got 18 albums. The last three albums, I think, it's almost as good as the first album.
Yeah.
You're never gonna. You're never gonna better your first album, whatever you do in life, because that's a whole life's work.
Yeah,
you've got 18 years, 20 years, 25 years to make that record. The next year after, you've got another year to make another record. You've got another year to make another 2 years. You haven't got that whole...
Yeah, of course.
The impetus is there. It's there to see. It's 25 years in the making. So.
But the diversity of the influences on this new record is quite something. I mean, there's everything, isn't there? Hold on, I've got a delivery. One sec.
That's all right.
Right, about that. I have to grab the cat or else he runs in.
Oh, bless.
where were we? We were talking about your latest album. I was saying the diversity of the influences on it. You know, a lot of really strong stuff on it as well. I really like it a lot. And I probably would not have known it was out were it not for the fact we were doing this. So I thank you for that.
That's a pleasure.
And I really want to encourage people to go and whatever they do nowadays, listen to it, stream it, download it, preferably. Is it on vinyl?
Yeah. It's on vinyl, yeah. I mean, I've had a few nice conversations. It's the album came out today. So I've had a few people.
Oh, it's actually today. Wow.
It came out today, apparently. Even though I got a lot of messages yesterday that say that they got it yesterday, but that's, I don't know. I'll just make the bloody thing. So.
Right.
It is what it is, and what we're doing is I'm not resting on new laurels and thinking that I can do Blue Room or Little Fluffy Clouds and do that all the time, and that's me, that's brilliant. It's prison or abolition. It's just taking fresh ideas and seeing what I could do with them in the 21st century.
Yeah, it sounds completely contemporary. That's the best thing, I think.
Brilliant. Well, that's just all good. I mean, I'm the last person who can sit there and talk about what I've done. I'd rather people just listen to it and then make their own ideas rather than me. It's so much better listening to my music than talking to me. Me talking is just not the same sort of...
Yeah, but I mean, people get an insight.
So here I am doing a little chat anyway, so I'll be quiet.
Yeah, but it means thank you for doing this. I appreciate the fact that you don't normally do it, so it's I feel honoured. And here's my cat. This is the important thing. Hold on, where is he?
Oh, wow. Hello.
This is Vito Corleone.
Hello, sweetie. How are you? Bless. Oh, she's come and meet my dog.
Yeah, I love cats anyway. But
Well, I like both.
Yeah, you like dogs as well, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we're getting to the end of this. I think this is appropriate. I have to get my notes from off his arse. And so I ask like stupid kind of smash hits type questions at the end of for everyone, but they're quite revealing normally. What's your favourite film?
I suppose Blade Runner.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Oh, Solaris. I mean, I've literally just found... They've just re-released the original Solaris.
Have they?
And I just watched it last night. And I sent it. I got it on to loads of people I know all over the world. I did a Solaris film. We've got our own record shop and radio station down in West Norwood.
Right.
And a few years before the pandemic, I used to do film nights, but I'd do my own music to the films.
Oh, nice.
And still have subtitles, so you'd know what was going on, but you'd have music by me. So I did a Solaris, a 2.5 hour.
Tremendous. And did you do it live?
Yeah. It was all, and my mate was saying, oh, have you got the film? Because don't be silly, I've recorded it, I've still got the recording. Is this this morning? Just telling him last night that they've just released the new Solaris.
And is it like super duper high definition remastered?
It's so rough as a film that it looks even rougher because it's super super.
Well, yeah, of course, because it exposes.
It's quite an amusing. But are you familiar with the original?
Yeah, I am.
So it's because it's this one that I filmed.
It's an incredible piece of work.
2.5 hours. Not much about. They had to make a film.
And then they did a new version, didn't they? Which was shit.
Yeah, that was an American version that was fucking awful.
Yeah,
the Americans trying to make it a fast buck. I think that was it.
Okay, what's your favourite TV show? Past, present, box set, anything you want?
Oh, Prisoner.
Now, that's interesting. I'll tell you why. Because with my other hat on, I've got a sound installation company, and we've done we've got a big relationship with Port Merion.
Got
several 3D sound installations there based on Clough Williams Ellis, who built the place and all that. And so I go up, I'm a member of the Prisoner Society. I've got a cape. They have a Prisoner Society and they give capes to different celebrities, I suppose you call them. Everybody from Richard Hawley and I'm number 17, which is perfect. And then there's loads of people who love the Prisoner, and we all go up there every year and have a kind of shindig.
That's cool. That's brilliant.
So cool. So I'm going to mention it to my friend Murray, who gives out the capes. And if you're a Prisoner fan, maybe we can.
Well, it's like they always think about the orb as well, where that bit's the inflatable that's bouncing about.
Yes,
like a giant orb.
That's what I did a 3D sound staging of the Prisoner with a new actor playing Patrick McGoohan's part for 2,000 people in the main square in Port Merion, and they had one of the giant weather balloons and everything.
Wow.
It was fucking great, man. It was one of the best things ever. Anyway, moving on. Book. Favourite book?
Oh, Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. If you...
Are you aware of that book?
What, Harry Potter?
It's about no, Philosopher's Stone by Colin Wilson. No, it's nothing to do with Harry Potter. I'm not that fucking bad. I'm not that stupid. It's all about...
I thought we'd move on quickly. No, I don't know it, no.
Yeah, okay, well, you should have a little look. Do a Google on Philosopher's Stone by Colin Wilson. Colin Wilson's an English author.
Right.
Recently died. He based himself, he was in Leicester. But then he moved all his down to Cornwall,
right?
And he's written hundreds of books, and I would say at least 80 of them I've read in my lifetime.
Wow!
So just just an amazing man.
Read 80 of them
easily, yeah. I know he's over 150 novels easily.
Wow!
It's just stunning, also.
Well, obviously, I've got to check this out. If you hadn't been a musician, I mean, it's obviously the only thing you've ever wanted to be, but if there'd have been an alternative career, how do you think that might have panned out?
Bloody awful. I wanted to be a football player.
I grew up,
and it's one of those days. I told you about my brother. Yeah. It's his anniversary today. I lost my dad when I was four, and he took the last thing I remember of him was him obviously dying on the day, but the day before he took me to Stamford Bridge to see Chelsea play. I was only three. Sure. We maybe become that, but it's what kept me and him together. The whole idea that him, me on his shoulders, going to the football.
That's right.
And that was it.
My son's got the same cousin.
We walked to football. We didn't get a bus. We didn't get a train. Yeah, we walked. We walked back again.
Yeah.
A local game.
Yeah, my son's got the same cousin. I'm especially a Wednesday fan, so you should worry.
I wonder when that was going to come up.
Oh, my God.
Do you know Ian Anderson by any chance?
Yes, I do. He's been on the podcast.
He's a dear friend, and he did a lot of our artwork.
I know he did, yeah.
First
I was going to ask you about him, actually. I forgot.
And we still, the last time he came to see us play in Sheffield, he was all down in the dumps because of football. Bless him.
Well, God knows what it'll be like now. We just missed out on automatic promotion. Bless him. Anyway, moving on. Which is your? I mean, I know the answer to this would change every day, probably. But who's your favourite musician, band, composer?
I'm going to stick my neck out and say Bob Marley, really, because that's something that I know that I can just instantly recall.
Yeah,
and the recall would be. Of course, I can't remember the name of the song. I've got suspicious minds in my head, but it's not that song.
No.
Redemption song.
Oh, I see.
Redemption song is probably one of the most best tunes ever written.
Yeah, it's
Redemption cool. song. And then Three Little Birds, best pop song ever made. So I'll stick my neck out and say,
all right, that's a good one.
Bob Marley.
Do you like visual art? Are you a fan of art in general?
I've got to say, yes, I am. Yes.
Okay, who's your favourite artist then? It could be a conceptual artist or...
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of... I shouldn't know his name, Andy Warhol.
Right, yeah.
That kind of, that direction. Pop art.
Yeah.
Pop-up art. That kind of stuff. That's what I kind of like most, I think.
Cool.
But then I grew up on a diet of Constable. But surely you must like Turner. Yeah, but Constable's got more detail. And they have that argument with people about the fluidity of Turner, where you've got a mist coming out.
Well, he's an impressionist, isn't he?
Brilliant stuff, though.
Brilliant.
Brilliant stuff. Both of them are brilliant.
Yeah.
About Constable, I've got to say, it's one of those, a lifelong thing from primary school.
The Italian kind of difference between Canaletto, who was like fucking photorealist almost, and like Giorgione, who was very impressionistic. Anyway, and finally, it sounds like you've had a few of these, but which is the most important one? An epiphanal moment in your life, a moment of realization. Or a handbrake turn.
I've had quite a few of them, yeah, sure. The thing was really giving up my day job for the Orb.
I did the same with the Human League. It was like my mum told me off because I was getting good money as a computer operator. I had to take... my wages were cut in half as soon as I joined the Human League. And of course, because you've been on Top of the Pops, everybody goes, well, you must be fucking rolling in it. But no.
Exactly.
I mean, a bit later we earned money with M17, but anyway. And the final question is, what's your favourite synthesizer?
I suppose it would be, I'm just saying ARP, but...
The ARP 2600 is amazing, in it. I know you like the Korg Electribe stuff and all that.
But they were fun, yeah, the Electribes. I'm just thinking, the thing that got me with Jimmy, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it's called, but they're big old mothers that I used to have to service it for Killing Joke. None of those things, how the Orb was born, and OBX.
Right.
The big OBXs.
Right.
I kind of had to look after one of these things for 8 years on the road. So I knew the mother, I knew how it worked, and then Jimmy went out and bought one.
Right.
And it's squatting.
They're big.
What'd you do with this? And of course, I knew how to switch it on and there I was. I did a track that afternoon by the Orb.
Did you?
On the back of the fact that I knew how to switch the thing on and knew the presets.
I think
it's too, be honest, but that's exactly
self-effacing. To be honest,
yeah. But then that is also the first two albums. The second album, especially, what's this for? Killing Joke is all. The synthesizer on that is an OBX, and it's a monster.
It's a solid sounding machine.
Evil stuff coming out there as well. Yeah. If you like Killing Joke,
not always able to control it, but I've used it a few times.
Well, then
one absolute pleasure is being.
Yeah, one other last thing, there's a Wasp, a Wasp keyboard.
Oh, the Wasp.
That was really, really good fun. And that takes me back to the first album, My Love of Reggae.
Is that right?
What's
that thing?
It was because the Wasp keyboard was all over lots of dub stuff, but Joe Gibbs used it a lot.
I didn't know.
So yeah. There you go.
And also it looked great, didn't it, the Wasp?
Yeah.
Yellow and black stuff. It was just fucking awesome.
Just rolling your fingers, don't, it's all clear.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway.
Well, anyway, we
there
got
you go. Thank you very much. I did actually. Yeah, thank you for
Alex,
entertaining my brain. And
yeah, I hope that we get to meet up at some point. It'd be really nice to shoot the breeze.
Well, if we're not in Sheffield, I'll be in Nottingham. I'll let you know. But right. Next time I'll fish Sheffield, I'll get you to come up with Ian. Because
I'm in London, so.
Oh, okay. Where were you? Marylebone.
Marylebone, yeah.
Okay. Well, kind of. That's number two bus. They're number two, West Norwood. That's where I live in West Norwood. And the number two bus goes
West
up.
Norwood,
and that's where I get. Okay.
The Crystal Palace ground or something. No. Yes.
That's it. Yeah. It's near Crystal Palace.
Yeah.
That's West Norwood. It's Upper Norwood. That's where Crystal Palace is. Upper Norwood.
So. Yeah. All right, man.
Yeah, well,
that was a joy, and
yeah, well, hopefully we all know.
I'd have dinner with a load of like-minded people, and that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
It would be lovely, yeah. Okay, well, look, stay in contact. Brilliant.
I will do, man, I will do.
All right. Thank you so much. Take it easy. Bye for now.
Ciao. Bye. Woo.
Alex, what a lovely guy, and yet another person from that scene that I never bumped into at the time, because it was kind of when we weren't doing much in the 90s, I suppose, and I was busy producing kind of pop. But I'm so glad I've made contact with him, and hopefully we'll stay in touch. And I do genuinely think his new album Prism is really good, and it's very eclectic and diverse and innovative, really, and so it's right up my street, I can honestly say that. How is everyone? Please consider the Patreon page to contribute to the making of this podcast, because at the moment it almost covers its cost with the patrons we've got. And thank you everyone for that. But I could do with a few more. So please consider it. Patreon.com/electronicallyhours. So there you go. Feel free to email me, electronicallymartin@gmail.com if you have any comments. That's it for this week. Another great guest next week. Bye.
Well done, Martin. What an interesting... Sorry, this is from Alex M. Well done, Martin. What an interesting and great choice of guest Zane Griff was. Super interview. And now I am listening to the Helden Project album, which before your interview with Zane, I never knew existed. Great work. It fits perfectly with the ethos of your podcast. Many thanks. Alex.
Thanks, Alex. That was nice. This is from Ken Evans. Hi, Martin and Glenn. Glenn's sadly not here, but I heard mention on the podcast of interest in doing an orchestral version of Decline of the West. Beautiful piece of music, by the way. Might I suggest that you have a chat with Tim Crooks, musical director with Manchester Camerata. His work for Hookey's Joy Division Orchestrated was absolutely outstanding. I met Tim Crooks at the Sydney Opera House show in 2019, but I don't have a contact for him. I expect Tim could be contacted through Hookey's manager, Pete Byrne, via this address. Cheers and Happy New Year, Ken Evans. Thank you.
Thanks
Ken.
For that suggestion. I'm actually in contact with John Wesley Barker about who's our original arranger for Temptation and Let Me Go, etc., about doing something for this. But I'll keep this on file. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
This is Declan Nolan. Hi, Martin. Really enjoying your podcast, which I've discovered on Podbean. Since I'm late to the party, I'm picking and choosing episodes to catch up. I have to say, an interview between yourself and respective friends didn't sound like an interview at all, more like a chat we've all been invited to. That is the idea. Howard Jones, Midge and Paul Humphreys, as examples, really seem like sound blokes with none of the ego trips we might expect. I think it's the benefit of talking to somebody who they regard as not only friends but kind of peers in the business. It's a different dynamic to if it's just an interview. Anyway, back to the letter. Peculiar now to hear the episodes at the height of the pandemic. That time was truly almost medieval. True. Suggestions for guests: Tony Mansfield of New Music.
That would be cool.
Yeah. Or Martin Gore or Dave Gahan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is from our patron, Scott H. Merry Christmas, Martin and team, and thanks for a brilliant podcast. I wanted to ask, have you ever come close to touring Australia? Just saw China Crisis on their first visit in 40 years and hoping an Aussie promoter may take a punt.
We have never played in Australia. I mean, it's not down to us. I mean, it's basically, if any Australian promoters out there can make a case for us coming out there and it can work economically, we'd be more than interested in talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Another Patreon comment from Timo Jalkinen. Thank you, Martin, for a wonderful year of your excellent podcast and your brilliant book. Lots of love to you and your loved ones. That's very kind.
Thanks, Timo.
Thanks, Timo.